Busy day, you and I chatting it up. Tuesday, October 8th, 2024 on Connecticut Today. I open the show with some startling new numbers regarding how unaffordable the state's becoming for many residents. CBS News correspondent Jim Krasula joined us from Wilmington, North Carolina, regarding the continuing Hurricane Helene cleanup. Intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, and former Green Beret Brian Boyd took a look at the current military situation in the Middle East, while WICC meteorologist Paul Piorek updated the situation with Hurricane Milton. And finally, Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio dropped by with her weekly update.
You know, generally in life, nice things, nice stuff, stuff that we want, nice vacations, nice places to live, safe places to live, are generally expensive. There's generally a premium in life, whether it's the type of steak you buy, whether it's your home entertainment system, whether it's the size of your home, whether it's where you live locally or where you live maybe nationally. And the reason I say that is because we always say that despite the, you know, some of the crying and moaning that we may do here on the show and in general on talk radio as I lead you band of merry folks every Monday through Friday from 2 to 6, we say that despite all the stuff that gets us cranky about the state of Connecticut, we like living here because it's nice. It's got its problems, right? But we all love our towns. We love Bridgeport and Trumbull and Shelton and Monroe and Danbury and Westport and Wilton and New Haven. We love, for some way, shape, or form, there are people that love and like living in all 169 cities and towns, or as people say, the fiefdoms of Connecticut. But, you know, with that, as usual, as nice things are, there's a cost. And there is a startling new survey out. And we talk about how often we see things in the news about how expensive it is to live in Connecticut and to exist here and to have a family life. Maybe you're a single person and maybe you've got, maybe you've got relatives, loved ones you live with. Maybe you're in a family, traditional or non-traditional. I got to tell you, though, just because Connecticut may be nice, it's getting tougher and tougher and tougher for folks just to live and exist here. And again, this is one of the issues that I always talk about that doesn't get any better. Yeah, we like what we like, and we know we're going to get nickeled and dimed to death usually every couple, 3 years on this fee and that fee. But this is serious stuff. New story here. In Hearst, Connecticut Media, this is Alex Putterman's story. There's a new United Way of Connecticut survey out there. And a lot of people, when you look at the aspects of what this survey says, are going to be nodding their heads because a lot of Connecticut problems come down to the fact that it's just really expensive to live here, to work here, and enjoy life here. And that's leaving a lot of people right on the edge. Get this. And again, this story has been, this survey has been foisted out in other areas. But I want to read you this. The number of Connecticut residents earning less than a living wage has increased in recent years. Life in Connecticut becomes increasingly difficult to afford. Think about that. Now, this is frightening. And I'm going to get to the operative question here. Well, the operative question here is, what do we do in a scenario where you have free and open markets of businesses, of homes, where if you're a purveyor of that business, if you're an owner of that home, if you're a developer, you want to get as much money as you can? But is this creating an untenable situation? There's a new report there, out there, from the United Way of Connecticut. Get this. 39% of the state's total number of households, about 564 households, 564,000, I'm sorry. So there's a new report out there, United Way of Connecticut. About 4 in 10 of all the households in the state, 40%, that's nearly 564,000 households, fell below the threshold at which they can afford essentials. Now, that's up and to and through the year before last, 2022. That was up 13% from 2019, rather. So think about that. If you and I, you know, like myself here, and I count my blessings every day, but think about that. If you and I are okay, maybe we're comfortable, we're a little above, a little below, 39% of the state's households, so that's roughly rounded up a little bit, easier to understand and comprehend, roughly 4 in 10 of Connecticut's households, 564,000, fell below the line, below the threshold at which they could afford essentials in 2022. That's up 13% from 2019. These households are particularly concentrated in urban areas, but they can be found in every single zip code. Now, I'm going to introduce you to an acronym here, ALICE, A-L-I-C-E. It's not a person. It's not Alice in Wonderland. It's not my mom. Her name was Alice. God rest her soul. But there is a figure here. There's an acronym, 5 words. If you put them together, it spells out ALICE. We'll tell you about that. And what that has to do with the fact that 4 in 10, 40% roughly, 39 to 40% of Connecticut's total number of households back in 2022 could barely, if at all, afford essentials. And of course, many of you folks have family, friends, loved ones, retirees you may know, or extended family in both Florida, which is staring down the barrel now of Hurricane Milton, and let's not forget parts of North Carolina still recovering from a vicious hit from Hurricane Helene in Wilmington, North Carolina. CBS's Jim Crisula joins us for a few minutes. Jim, good afternoon. Thank you for the time. And talk about what's still going on there, Jim, because my fear is a lot of people are going to push, you know, what's going on where you are aside in their minds because of Milton. But how's that recovery coming where you are?
Hi, Paul. Good to talk to you. There's still about 100,000 homes and businesses without power, especially in western North Carolina, the mountains of western North Carolina. Some 500 roads remain closed, Paul. About 100 bridges have been washed away. Portions of I-40 remain closed, especially near the Tennessee border. That busy highway, several spots, several locations, it was washed away by the rains from Hurricane Helene. Remember, nearly a half a year's worth of rain fell in just a couple of 3 days in the southern Appalachian Mountains. By the way, it could be sometime next year before Interstate 40 is reopened. They are still conducting search and rescue missions, Paul. There are still people missing. The exact number's not clear, but they're still looking for people who may be missing, victims' bodies, people who may still be in isolated homes across the mountains of western North Carolina.
Yeah, Jim, this is, from what I've been able to see on television, this is pretty rugged country, isn't it? This just is not somewhere where you zip in and out by an interstate, is it?
That's exactly right. I mean, a lot of people, Paul, live in the mountains of western North Carolina for a reason. They want to be isolated. They want to be out there on their own. They don't want people in their lives. So, again, you're dealing with a situation like that. I saw something, I think it was yesterday, kind of put things in perspective, that the amount of damage, the area that has been damaged by these floodings in eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina is the size of Massachusetts.
Wow.
So, again, it's a huge, huge area. And I suspect, Paul, you know, it's going to be a situation where some places may never be the same because of what happened a week and a half ago with this rain and the subsequent flooding.
And I would imagine, Jim, that we're talking about air assets in some impassable areas. I mean, are we talking drones to take a look and then helicopters to actually get in there and see what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. And also in this high-tech age, they're using, in some cases, mule teams and horses to bring stuff into these areas that are so badly damaged and so inaccessible at this point.
All right. Jim Crisula. Jim, thank you. Wilmington, North Carolina there. Jim, stay safe, and we appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Be well.
All right. Thank you. CBS News, you hear him right here on WICC. Jim Crisula. How about that? Yeah. Lest we not forget, yesterday we marked 1 year since the beginning of hostilities. This time around, the Hamas forces attacking Israel, and now the Middle East is now developing into a real powder keg. How do we keep this from degenerating into World War III? A gentleman we've had on a number of times here. Great to have him back. 30-year-plus professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, law enforcement professional, former Green Beret, involved with stuff in D.C. as well. The website, BoydIntelligence.com, BoydIntelligence.com. Brian Boyd joins us. Hey, Brian, it's Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
Good to hear your voice. It's been a while, but I'm here to help you any way I can.
Well, Brian, thank you. We appreciate that. So, man, we have the Israeli forces. We have Hamas. We have Gaza. We've got Hezbollah. We've got Lebanon. We've got the Houthis. We've got Iran. Brian, how do we keep this whole thing from blowing up into World War III?
Well, it's not going to be a World War III type situation. If you kind of look back and understand how Iran in 79 began this movement of helping to create various Shia Muslim groups around the world, including Hezbollah, who followed it in 82 and has been taking over parts of Lebanon. You got the Houthis who got their inflammatory issues over gas shits, and now they've got it. But you've got basically Iran providing missiles, all of which are about the size of an SUV.
Wow.
And they're providing them, and they got lots of money. Now, we have gotten ourselves in this quagmire in this administration because we took a conciliatory approach, and they've been having lots of money, and they're spending it on lots of ballistic missiles. And since their goal is to eliminate Israel, all Jews and Christians from the Middle East, which is their charter since 79, it's in the charter of Hamas, it's in the charter of Hezbollah, which are political groups as well.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as that's going on, Israel is in a strategic fight. They're not in a large-scale fight of troops yet, even though they're doing incursions in Lebanon. The object is to degrade Iran to such a point that they can no longer provide missiles. So the big discussion on the national TV is whether or not to attack nuclear sites, military sites, or sites of infrastructure. And that's the big issue. And that's what the Israelis are going to do, one of those three.
Mm. So, Brian, when we hear nuclear sites, I mean, obviously now people are saying, well, whoa, do they mean power reactors? Do they mean a facade for something that they're trying to develop into weapons or to take out any weapons they may have? There's a question of radioactive fallout. I mean, take us into that. What do you think? If the Israelis do that, what would they target? What do you think?
Well, when the transition occurred between Trump and Biden, we weren't paying attention to the Iranians. They snuck behind everybody's back, and they started getting a lot more of fusible uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it. They got well beyond the limits that were guaranteed or promised by the United Nations. So they've been stockpiling this. And so any nuclear sites that would be hit would be those that are planning to build bombs. It's not going to be anything else but that. And it is one of their targets, but they want to be able to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear bomb. As you saw this last strike in Israel, some of those ballistic missiles got through the Iron Dome. The Iron Dome has been a good protection, as has been David Sling and all the others. However, it's not perfect,
mm-hmm.
and if they get a nuclear weapon, it'll break through. So they're in a position to where they need to disable and destroy nuclear facilities that are designed for building nuclear missiles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they know the difference, and it won't create a nuclear fallout. There's ways to do it. If you remember some years ago, they killed one of the physicists. They're used to doing it. They have special operations intelligence, and they know how to get inside. And they've tried to intimidate Iran to stop doing this, but they have no desire. Now, let me give you a segue.
Sure.
The issue in Iran is the mullahs have been in control since the late 70s, since 79. So the control of Iran is by these older guys in their 80s, and they're losing touch and control with their population. And so they're more concerned about maintaining their control of their population. Several years ago, when the students did an uprising, General Soleimani, who was head of the Quds Force, killed a lot of students and put a lot in jail.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a time, and I think General Keane said this the same as I've said it, probably within a year, you're going to have an uprising of the population against these older mullahs, and you may have a change in their regime. But the big threat is the nuclear threat, and the big issue is they're having a nuclear ballistic missile, which could decimate Israel. So that's why the Israelis are so intent on winning this event, by destroying Hezbollah and their ballistic missiles. But the next step is, what are they going to do about Iran? You know, they don't want to destroy the country.
Yeah.
Infrastructure could affect it. Going at the specific nuclear sites might be practical. Militarily, Iran will not get into a war with Israel because they don't have an army, an air force, or a navy. So that's not going to occur. So they're in a delicate position. They got to maintain peace at home, to maintain control. And all they've got is lots of money and lots of missiles. There's no tanks and planes involved. So it's a war of missiles and war of nuclear potential. That's basically a one-liner.
Yeah. The website BoydIntelligence.com, as usual, great analysis. There are defense expert here, Brian Boyd. Brian, good to chat with you. Stay safe, and I'm sure we'll be chatting in the weeks to come. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the invitation, Paul. I'll do my best.
All right. Thank you, sir. Brian Boyd there. Check it out, BoydIntelligence.com, 30-year-plus intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, law enforcement, serving in the Departments of Defense, Justice, and Treasury, national expert, appears on television, former Green Beret, and was part of the SEAL Joint Special Operations Command, overseeing Special Forces and SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force. Just heard from this gentleman. We're going to have him on live right now for a little bit of an extended discussion as to what's going on here with this Hurricane Milton. Paul Piard joins us. And Paul, good afternoon. And in 40-plus years of covering these things, I don't think I've ever seen the warnings, Paul, and the outward, I guess I would have to say, fear or trepidation from you folks in the forecasting community that I'm seeing here. I might be wrong, but I can't remember it being this much of a dire situation.
And you are right, Paul, no doubt about that. You know, last week we said historic for Helene, and this week historic again. This Hurricane Milton right now, it is a Category 4, but just about a 5. The maximum winds right now are about 155 miles an hour. It is moving east-northeast at about 8. And right now, as of this hour, 500-plus miles just southwest of Tampa. Now, historically, this hurricane, number one of the hurricanes with the strongest winds. Earlier, it had wind gusts of about 180 miles an hour, making it in the top 10, Paul, in Atlantic hurricanes as far as wind speed is concerned. And the ones that exceeded that, you may remember a number of these. Allen back in 1980, Gilbert in 88, Dorian in 19, and Wilma in 05. They had 185-mile-an-hour winds.
Wow.
And the strongest wind gust was Allen back in 1980 with 190. So this is right up there, number one. And number two, last night the pressure dropped down to about 997 millibars, making it the fifth most intense hurricane on record in the Atlantic Basin.
Now, Paul, usually, just the news-consuming folks like myself, we're used to seeing these things form in the Caribbean and take that usual course toward Cuba, toward, Jamaica, toward the southern tip of Florida. But I think this one is kind of raising people's eyebrows because, Paul, is it me or do we rarely see this strong of a hurricane moving laterally from the west to the east in the Gulf of Mexico?
You're right, Paul. You know, very rare for this. And, you know, you mentioned a moment ago fear and trepidation with this path. And you're right, it is moving in this line toward Tampa Bay, and it should hit or make landfall by tomorrow night. And when it does, it should be a Category 3. But by then, of course, hopefully everybody has evacuated because it's going to be quite a strong hurricane by tomorrow night. And you know, we worry about, where is it going to land? Where is it going to make landfall? What will the storm surge be like? And what about the damage? And there's going to be a lot of damage from this hurricane. Again, you're talking about wind speeds here that you and I, about a week ago, chatted about.
Yeah.
you know, when we get a strong wind gust of 50 miles an hour, it's big news. I mean, this is 155, and, Paul, it is getting stronger this hour.
And they have been warning. I've seen that, Paul. They say, don't forget, folks, stuff that, I mean, pieces of wood, pieces of metal, pieces of glass, they potentially could kill you if they're flung at you at over 100 miles an hour.
You're right. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head. These are going to be like missiles, you know, when they're flying at this rate of speed so very rapidly. Yeah, it will be deadly. There's no doubt about it. And I certainly hope those that are in the path of this hurricane have evacuated by now, because if you wait any longer, you run the risk and danger of not being able to get out in time.
And, Paul, finally, it's going to exit, they say, and you just said it'll exit off the east part of Florida here. Every cone I'm seeing shows the exit here. Is there any shot this makes kind of a northern turn and heads up the coast, or is that not in the cards right now?
It's not in the cards. In fact, every model we're looking at right now is showing, you're right, it's moving in this east-northeast direction, where we are not going to feel any effects whatsoever up here, you know, and we're just thinking about those down in Florida and what's going to happen over the next 24 to 48 hours.
Mm-hmm. All right, Paul Piark. Paul, thank you, and we'll definitely check back in with you likely tomorrow, okay?
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it there. Paul Piark, yeah. So you would hope, again, as Paul said, everybody who wants to get out can and indeed has gotten out. Again, this a hurricane of historic proportions. Luckily, we will not see the remnants of it, as Paul said, but, I mean, come on, who doesn't have a workmate, a friend, a family member, immediate or extended in that area in Florida? We'll keep you updated right here on WICC. All right, Megan Portfolio. I don't know how to segue between that and Megan Portfolio, so I'll just say she's here from the Yankee Institute.
How are you?
Well, I mean, how do I segue from Kamala Harris on CBS getting hammered there by Bill Whitaker to you? Now, before we get to the subject of your blog this week, I have to ask you. Last time we spoke, you were sprinting out to do some of your Halloween shopping. What's the update with that?
Oh, I got some good stuff. I got awesome clown. I love scary clowns. I really only
like
them.
Oh, really? You're one of those. Okay.
Well, people get triggered by them, and I, for some reason, gravitate towards things that trigger people.
I'm shocked. Yeah.
So I have all these clowns on my porch, and it freaks out the whole neighborhood. But he's so cool because he's got a little camera in his nose, so when you walk by, his head follows you.
Wow, that's we're finding out a lot here about one of our favorite bloggers.
I know, it's the little things that make me happy. But you had me all, I don't know what you were talking about earlier, but Dorothy's got me all bummed out.
Well, it's that United Way survey that came out today that basically said 4 in 10 households in the state is barely making it. Oh, why? Gee, it's a little expensive to live here, ain't it?
Tell me about it. Yeah. And they only want us to spend more.
Yeah,
so there's a good segue.
So let's segue into your new column. What do you have for us?
So there was this union convention, because I do a lot of, I watch the unions really close. And they had this, the machinists had a convention out in New York City. And why is that important to Connecticut? Well, one of the speakers there, he founded the Connecticut Roundtable for Climate and Jobs, which is this huge activist group in the state. They were pushing for the gas car ban, anything environmental, they push for it. But the interesting thing about this is it's like, is this a climate crisis or is it a union membership crisis? Mm-hmm. Because they're making it seem like the only way we can stop rising sea levels and polar bears from dying is if you have a union card. They're literally trying to be the gatekeepers of all things environment. And why that's important to Connecticut is, if you go online or anything, social media, I mean, it pops up on my feed all the time. You see all these union guys, you know, supporting certain candidates because it's election time. And the stuff that they want is really, really not going to be good for us, especially with our electric bills. Like this group, you know, they're pushing for Lamont to sign up for this very, very costly offshore wind. So anyway, at this convention, the whole thing was about, you know, oh my God, climate change, it's ruining everything. And then my ears perked when this guy, what was his name? John Harrity. He threw out the word collective. He said, the fight on climate change is literally about our collective survival.
Oh boy.
I'm like,
oh,
okay. Once I hear collective, my mind goes straight to the commies. And he's like,
wait a minute. I don't think we want to call anybody communist here,
no,
do
not,
we?
Okay. I will say I'm not calling him a commie. It's just a word that they use, the communists like to use back in the day.
I know. Collective. Well, yeah, everything was for the collective good, Megan. Don't you understand it? It's for the collective good.
But if it's honestly, if you're telling me there's a crisis, that means all hands on deck. That means I don't care if you're Republican. I don't care if you're a Democrat. We're human beings. We're Americans. Mm-hmm. We need to like get together and work together to solve this. Like just like with the hurricanes going on, I've been seeing so many things, you know, on my social media from, you know, it's not a party situation. These poor people down there are getting hammered and we're all like coming together. That's what you do when there's a crisis. But if you're telling me that we have this climate crisis, why do these jobs have to all be union jobs? And let me tell you about these union jobs. Okay. I mean, they want to make it so that all these projects like offshore wind have what's called the project labor agreement, which basically boxes out any non-union contractor from doing the work. Now, they had done a study between 2001 and 2019 on school construction projects, which were all project labor agreements. Mm-hmm. And the taxpayers got, oh my God, I'm trying to think of a PG word, but for this, but we basically got screwed over for $500 million in overcosts because they were project labor agreements instead of opening it up to the free market, let the best bid win, etc. So it's just something that I want to put on everyone's radar screen. When you see this stuff with these unions and they're talking about the climate change, they're not talking about climate change. They're using it, and they come out and say that they're using it to recruit more members and unionize more industries. So it's just something to be conscious of when you hear this and when you see who they're supporting for office. These activists, I mean, they're still out to ban the gas cars.
I can't believe they're going to bring that. You said they're going to bring that back again after the first of the year.
Oh, yeah, they're going to bring that back. They haven't stopped talking about it. I mean, I don't know if what's going to happen in the presidential election. Yeah. I don't know if President Harris is, you know, in favor of that. I mean, that could come down from the federal level, and which, you know, it's hard for us to fight that. But on the state level, they're definitely talking about it, and they definitely want it. I don't know who's going to win the elections if those candidates are, you know, going to comply with it. But
meantime, in a state where we barely have enough grid capacity now, and nobody wants to allow anything, you know, whether I was talking about this earlier in the week, Megan, how about a kudos to the governor who says, well, you know, we need a power line to come down from Hydro-Quebec. No, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire say we can't do that. The governor says, well, we need more natural gas. No, New York State said they won't allow an extension of a pipeline. So we're going to have to churn butter and sing kumbaya. I mean,
I'm glad you brought up the natural gas.
Yeah.
Because it is cleaner than oil.
Yes.
It is cleaner than gas. So if I'm trying to protect the environment and I want the climate, you know, I want a healthy climate, healthy air, you're telling me we can make it better with natural gas, then why are we not going for that? But no, they don't want, they won't even accept like a little bit of change to make it better.
Nope.
They want the union jobs. They want to be able to organize more industry, which comes at a higher cost.
Hey.
So is it really about the environment?
How many union jobs could they have, Megan, you know, extending those pipelines and bringing that, those feeder lines down from Hydro-Quebec? Hello.
Like, why are you blocking? If you're telling me that this will help our air quality in our cities, why are we not doing it? Even if it's a little bit better, if it's better than coal, it's affordable. Mm-hmm. It's way more affordable than this offshore wind.
Yeah.
So why are we like poo-pooing that?
Well, I think that's a rhetorical question. Megan Portfolio, check it out online, Yankee Institute, the Hartford Portfolio. Megan, have fun. I'm sure you'll buy more Halloween stuff between tonight and the next time we talk. So I'm looking
forward. Oh, yeah, I got another coupon, so I'll be going this weekend.
Have a nice
I'll talk to you next week.
Have a nice week. Bye-bye.